Hey everyone, it's Noor, host of AdTech Unfiltered. This week we're speaking about fearless leadership in advertising and marketing with Sean Finnegan. He's a co-founder and partner at hybrid consulting and marketing services firm Chameleon Collective. If you've long worked in the Chicago or New York advertising scene, you may know Sean from a series of his other leadership roles in the ad business. He's done a ton of stuff, from digital leadership roles at OMD, to president of Starcom MediaVest Group, to co-founder of C4 Group. I speak to Sean about how he's done it and what it takes to be a fearless leader while exploring uncharted waters again and again. This episode on being a fearless founder starts right now. Sean, I really appreciate you making some time to chat today.
Thank you for having me.
And I especially appreciate it today because I know that very shortly after this podcast concludes that you need to head down the street to do something else at a really fancy engagement. Can you tell me what you'll be doing right after?
Yeah, and it's why I'm wearing a tie and it's choking me. I haven't worn a tie in probably since I left the agency space. Yeah, I'm heading here to the American Advertising Federation Hall of Achievement. We love to congratulate ourselves in the advertising business, and there's many of them. But I would say that this is, from my knowledge, the most exclusive award in the business. Since 93, just a little over 200 people have been inducted into the Hall of Achievement. And it is a 40 and under award, so it recognizes people that have achieved a level of success in their work world. Why I think it's really special is it recognizes also the personal development and charitable achievement that people have done. In order to get into this, you need to be a combination of Mother Teresa and Warren Buffett. You really have to be sacrificial and successful at the same time. And one of my boys I'm very proud of, John Halverson, is being inducted today. So I have the honor of swearing him in, if you will.
I'm looking forward to learning more about what got you into a place where you were inducted, and a big piece of it seems to be not only the fact that you climbed in the ranks at a variety of agencies that aren't only renowned here in Chicago, but across the United States and also globally recognized, and that it subsequently led you to choosing to build a series of your own businesses. And there's so many that I admittedly tried to research all of them so I could ask all these pointed questions. And the reality is it's really hard to keep track of them.
Yeah, so I hear that a lot.
So we'll get you to help us break it all down. So let's start at the beginning, where you started off in this business. I think you were telling me earlier you started off at BBDO. What was the series of steps in terms of when you decided that you were going to commit yourself to this industry?
My dad was in sales and marketing here in Chicago at the Commonwealth Edison for 33 years, and I saw his ability to navigate left brain and right brain to some analyses on business plans, to being a good friend and a relationship builder. And I saw that he enjoyed his work. It started to come naturally to me that I also became interested in that as well. And so then I studied advertising down in Kentucky, Murray State University. From there, I had an internship at BBDO New York. After a summer internship, they hired me back in the spring.
So after BBDO, after you started working, and I think BBDO falls under the umbrella of which large
Omnicom.
Company? Under Omnicom, and I know you did a series of roles there. When did you start strategizing as far as figuring out how do I climb in the ranks here when there are so many other people working under that same line of business?
Back then, 94 is when I started, February of 94. That was when ad agencies were still integrated. That was when the creative department was down the hall from the media department, when the creatives were the rock stars and the account people were these, wranglers, and the media folks were the last 2 minutes of every meeting. What also happened at that same time was the web was launched. You'd always had the walled gardens before, Prodigy, CompuServe, AOL, et cetera. But once Netscape came out, that was a changed game. And a bunch of us saw the possibilities of the interactive space, direct marketing element to it, one-to-one. And navigating within that culture and sphere, a few of us got together and created what was called then the BBDO Tech Setters. And at that point, management didn't care. They were just like, whatever, kids. You guys want to sit around nights and weekends on your computer and wait half an hour for a single page to load of somebody's dog in Germany, then, have at it.
Yeah.
And it just grew from there into the entire industry started to just completely grow. And, the heat of a cool company like a TikTok today was the same heat that Yahoo had back then.
Did you think that that resonated throughout the industry, or did only a couple of people really feel energy there? Because I think oftentimes people gravitate towards what's really hot. And to me, even though I was a kid in like 93, 94, I knew a lot of other people who really felt like, I don't know if this thing is really going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
And did people in the agency feel similarly?
Yeah, definitely. There was, you know, you're wasting your time. This is never going to happen. People were actively trying to thwart it. Yeah, no, there was a lot of naysayers, clients included. You know, I remember a particular auto that I worked at. And to think back then that this major auto was telling us that there was no future in interactive presence or media, and that cars will always be sold personally and on lots, is exactly the types of conversations we were having across the board.
Going back to building yourself up through Omnicom, where did your last position fall as far as like how high up on the chain? What was your highest title?
Well, it was media planner. So what was happening at that time, to your point on the amount of people adopting this business, is that there weren't a lot of us and we were in pretty high demand. And every year or two, you'd get a call for somebody across the street basically saying, I'll double your income and your title. And
for digital media planner?
For digital.
Not just media planner.
Just digital. Yeah, digital.
Okay.
So those were lucrative days. You couldn't turn it down. So I actually had went to a few agencies from there. I went to Zenith Media to start their interactive department, to J. Walter Thompson, and to rise to media director in the digital space. And then from there, I got tired of giving all of these hot startups media billings and seeing everybody just make kajillions of dollars. And I decided to go for broke and join one of the dot-coms, and of which I didn't make any kajillions of dollars. Well, it was in 99 to 01. I joined a startup. I'm just not going to name because it was just horrible. But people that know me know it. And it was a fun model, and we had a lot of great people in it. But it was right at the dot-com bust.
And so that was your first jump away, this company that will remain nameless, as far as suddenly deciding that maybe the word suddenly isn't necessary for me to add. Maybe it took you a while to realize a lot of people are making a lot of money off of strategic advice that you're providing. And so you decided to make this jump. It wasn't successful, it doesn't sound like, but at the same time, it didn't deter you from choosing to jump back out into that world. But you didn't do it immediately, right? First, did you go back to Starcom, is what it was?
No, that's when I went. I was in New York for that whole time. And then that's when I came back here to help launch OMD. I did so through Tribal DDB here in Chicago. And then OMD was formed, and I was the Midwest leader. And then quickly the business rebounded as a whole. The industry recovered from the bust. And I had, I think I picked the right horse and we did a couple of good things and built a nice, fun culture. And I was then moved back to New York from Chicago to then head up OMD nationally and then eventually the digital unit globally for the holding company.
What's the most important part of being a leader in a business for you?
Planning is critical. You know, every day in terms of a leader, and I say leader with a capital L now because I'm running a bunch of small companies. They're not the big agency world. And I don't have people reporting to me, except I just work equally now with a series of my partners in these businesses. But I think in order to benefit them, I come to the table with every day a forethought plan of what I want to get done that day. By the way, a subset of that is in my daily list. I list out what are the things that I truly hate. What are the things that are annoying me, and I do those first. You know, I have my vegetables first, and then I have the rest of the day for cake. It's usually not that glorious, but if you let it linger and you don't tackle those things that you don't like but have to get done, it just gets worse. It just, the negativity, the pain compounds. It doesn't go away.
So how do you make sure that when you're employing other people to do the work that you know you don't have a strength for doing, how do you make sure that they're doing the work right?
Yeah, great question, because I take a lot of pride in hiring many people over my career that do certainly better and also different things that I have ever done or know to do. But I have a sense of their skill. And I also get it validated by other experts that in those, say it's in legal or financial or technical or some form of our media business that that takes particular vertical strengths. You get a sense from them whether they're doing the job or not based on the client's reaction and reception and their continuance to pay you. I've loved the diversity of types of skill sets that I've been able to hire over the years and have absolute 100% confidence in putting those people in and then hiring people, like I said, much better than I am because it's just a reflection back on you and your ability.
One thing I'm really taking away from this conversation is that you are quite comfortable with something going wrong. If something goes wrong, you're ready to rebuild or to let go of the past in terms of if something has gone ineffectively.
Yeah.
When did you realize that about yourself as far as having that character trait? And is that, do you agree, is that what's propelled you to just continuously pursue new business?
You know, I think that my family probably has been the driver to that. Just like anyone, I would love to run and hide when bad things occur. But I have no choice. You know, I have a family to support, and I think of them as my backstop and my safety net and my future potential. And so if anything negative occurs in my life, that they are my joy and hope and my ability to renew myself and just focus on the problem at hand and just tackle it and just start to dismantle it and fix it.
I think some people might use that same explanation to address the problem differently. They would say, I have a family that I need to support, so I have to stop taking these risks and being an entrepreneur or take as many risks as you have taken. How has that grounded you to route things in a successful way as opposed to going down a pathway where you're saying, I don't know what I'm doing here. Why am I taking these risks?
Right. Yeah, really good question because I certainly have, I could have taken that route. I could have still been sitting in some big agency seat and but I think it's what I learned for me is that answer was a fallacy, that there was not a sense of safety or consistency or growth for what I'm good at or what I'm passionate about or where there's a business. Those three things that I learned painfully through an executive coach that I employed back in my Omnicom days that I've kept close to ever since, I realized that in the agency seat at Omnicom and Publicis that I just wasn't enjoying. So that's when I learned. I thought, you know what, this is not happening here. I'm really not enjoying myself.
Did you go too high? Is that what happened though, Sean? Like, when you're at the C-suite level or you're the president, like if you're a coach in the NBA, it's not a lean back position, right? You have to succeed or you're going to get cut. Does it make more sense for sometimes people to stall out a little bit lower so you're still doing the sexy and creative stuff as opposed to being caught up in the operations?
I certainly agree to that sentiment where people don't need to continue to go north to be successful. You don't need to be promoted out of your job. That's one of the agency weaknesses is that you see somebody doing very well for a client and suddenly you want to make them in charge of the region or the territory. And you're like, that's not what I'm doing well with this client and these strategies. Now you're putting me in charge of P&L and HR and legal. I'm not good at any of that crap. And I wasn't personally. Now, the other thing I figured out too, certainly in the boardrooms is that, like I said, it's just a whole new game. You're there monitoring over multinational business plans and you're doing M&A and you're dealing with thorny management issues and clients that are looking to fire you every day. And it's just not fun. Paid incredibly well, not fun at all. And yeah, it wasn't having any fun. And I think that I think I'm a spoiled brat enough to know that I'm not going to be successful if I'm not doing what I like. I needed to just completely, I'd say, reinvent myself, but also that I should take the risk on deploying that equation of good at, passionate about where there's a business equally in three parts. One can't exceed the other. and really bet on that and bet on myself. And when I left the agency space, it was you know, pretty risky. And I just thought, I'd like to see if I could, maybe, who cares about awards, but I'd like to see if I could build successful companies and truly know what it's like to, through the line from inception, product development, certainly the marketing and promotion of it, to the deployment and then continual success of a solution, see if I could do that versus just sitting on top of some media mountain.
So that's my next area of curiosity is, now we're making the jump. We realize that maybe we've climbed so high, we've climbed into territory that's no longer really of our interest. Like, the stress is unbearable, I would imagine, at some point.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
And so now we're just going to take on stress that we've chosen to take on, i.e. starting our own business. So what was the first business that you started after leaving the agency business behind?
So I started a company called the C4 Group. The C4 Group was a go-to-market strategy type firm where a couple of dedicated employees and project managers, we basically reverse engineered what we were doing on the media buying side for the benefit of the media and marketing and technology community. So as we were working to position the Fortune 500 brands at the large holding companies, we were taking those same types of skill set and approaches to the people in the B2B space.
Sean, who's we? We're already weeing. Who's in our group? Who are the other people?
Oh, you mean you want actual names?
Not necessarily the names, but like you've left the organization and now you're starting your own thing. How are you gathering?
Then I was truly just on my own. Okay. I had, like I said, a couple people that were dedicated employees that were former media buyers, and then also project managers, but also contractors as well, working with them, so that we developed this business networked business plan that we could essentially help these media companies in this web of the Lumascape out there differentiate themselves back into the brand and agency community. And so everything from their positioning in the marketplace, you know, some of their collateral, to their sales proposition, to their events plan, to PR, to connections, sales, conversions, to recruiting, et cetera. People had said it was like a mini MediaLink at that time, and very mini versus MediaLink. But
and for people who don't know what MediaLink is, a little
it's everything I just rattled off. They do it at about 1,000 times of size of what I was doing.
Sure.
And they were just they were sold and have great things in front of them. But that's what I was doing. And then one of my clients that I was working in this capacity for, Truex, a guy named Joe Marchese, then said, "Hey, why don't we take you out? And we'll buy the firm, and you can come in and then deploy all the assets inside of Truex." And Truex is an engagement advertising technology company.
Before you go any further, we kind of jump from you came into existence to you were successful, to you were being bought. How did you get buy-in in the industry? Who were the clients that you were going after? What was specifically niche to the audience you wanted to find versus who you were originally pitching in the ad business or
well,
the agency business?
One component that's critical to your question that I also take a lot of pride in is that while I was on the media buying side, I believe I operated it differently than maybe some of my peers at competitive agencies, where I didn't need to have clout in billings to get a sense of self-worth. I already had enough confidence, and it's not, I don't have my job to justify who I am as a human, and I'm just good to people. And that came through in my negotiation style and structure and strategy, where I was actually the type of buyer where I would overpay based on the market rate, but I would get double in return and I would be a good guy about it. And I would, you know, not rake people over coals and I would work with them on any issues. Half the problem of media buying is actually getting what you bought. It's a little secret out there. But, and that's the differentiator of why you would buy someone is that, are you, okay, I get what you do, but are you actually going to give me back what I just sold through to my client? only works about half the time. So when that happens, how are you going to react to that? And how are you going to work with them in that capacity? How are you going to maintain that revenue and that expense and that relationship with them? And I think I did that in a relationship building way over the years that so inevitably kept a good name and a good good reputation that when I left, I had, and still today, thankfully, no shortage of inbound biz dev opportunities. Now, I can't say that for my peers that I was up against. I mean, you know, it's always funny to see these people that were these clout-bearing media spender jerks that then get just, you know, made people's lives miserable. And then suddenly they find themselves in the industry realizing that, you know, they didn't have any, they don't have any friends out there.
But I always wonder about that because, I mean, I was only at a big holding company for a short period of time. Do people in the long run not care because they know that you had clout and you were relevant and you know a lot of people and they say, well, you know, that was yesterday. Today's a new day. I guess I'm going to try to come through for you because you're relevant in the industry? Or do you feel that people remember and that being kind to people goes a long way?
Yeah, I do. The latter. I think that people remember the essence of you. We can all have, especially in the media space, many jobs and many lives. But I think that people just remember Noor. They remember Sean. They don't remember, you know, that it comes up, you know, bios and stuff and accolades and, oh, you were this and that. But what they remember was you were successfully able to do this for you, for me, for us to work together. And let's do that again in whatever iteration, in whatever jerseys we're wearing, buy, sell, brand, whatever. Yeah. So I think that continues on.
Going back to something that you were talking about, which is the sale of the sale to Truex, I
yes.
believe is what
mm-hmm.
it was. So there's so many names. C4
Group, and then was then folded into Truex.
Okay.
And then I was there operating as chief strategy officer in charge of sales and marketing.
Okay.
And then after 2 years, Truex was sold to 21st Century Fox. And then integrated into that company. Joe did a great job of that transaction. And I decided that wasn't for me. I had gotten the entrepreneurial bug. I didn't want to go into a large company, into this case, 21st Century Fox, or anyone, quite honestly. Then I created my next company.
Why was 21st Century Fox, why did they buy Truex?
They bought Truex, I believe, because the technology was something that, and still is, growing and effectual for their business and growth, where, you know, it was very video-based and entertainment-oriented, long-form content, sight, sound, and motion. And it was a great technology, it is a great technology. They also, I believe, bought it because of the professionals inside. They're truly a lot of very innovative strategists and sellers and producers that in the digital space that Fox took a look at and said, we need more of these types of people inside. Now, I thought, I was just having this conversation last night with Joe, that once a tiny business, it was, you know, pretty big transaction, you can look it up for yourself, but...
Wait, pretty big transaction. What
they
did,
were sold.
What was your company sold for to 21st
Century? Truex, not my company, where this Truex. Is where I was working at. Okay. Truex was sold for $200 million into
okay.
21st Century Fox.
Yeah.
And so usually when they're sold to that degree, it's an acqui-hire, it's a technology integration, and then they just become employees. And maybe some of that happened, but the 21st Century Fox was really smart enough to leave the brand identity alone and continue to do well. And also now, as you probably know, 21st Century Fox has been sold into Disney. So everyone's becoming Disney employees, but the Truex brand remains.
So the long and the short of it is, you're not getting into another big corporate entity at 21st Century Fox. You're going
right.
to go off in your own direction. What's next? What are you working on?
So I just thought, we were having a lot of the meetings, and I just thought, you know, this is great, but it's not for me. It's not. I'm now confident in my design. I want to build something, and I want to have it grow, and I want to be part of something. So let's go back and build again. So some people know that I'm friends with the Jonas Brothers, of all people.
How did you meet the Jonas Brothers?
I met Mr. Jonas Sr. back when I was on the media buying side. And they had actually owned a business called Cambio, C-A-M-B-I-O, that was part of AOL. And good friend Tim Armstrong introduced me to Kevin Sr. And we did some deals on this. And then we just became friends. And then I have two daughters that were, you know, of the Jonas fan variety at the time and still are. And invited us to a show and got to know the boys and just became friends over time. And then when they broke up back in 2013 or so, Kevin Jr. Approached me, Kevin, and said, hey, let's do something together. Because while he was in the band, you know, Nick and Joe were doing a lot of their creative-based work, and clearly Kevin, who also is creative, clearly, but also was working with his dad on more of the business aspects of the business, as he explained, you know, the contracts and sponsorships and social presence and connecting with the communities around the world. So that was – Kevin's an incredibly smart, creative guy. I love just listening to him, just like any successful professional. And he just said, look, I know this social space. You know brands. Let's get together. So we created a company called, kind of a mouthful of a name, but called the Ambassador Exchange, which was basically, again, this is 2013. This is not, you know, 6 years later, and there's the social influencer space is, I still think, growing and also in a need for differentiation and still has a lot of growth in front of it, tremendous amount to be figured out. So we put this together, and it was about creating original content with influencers, but then also we were finding them through the same way that I did media planning. I was basically saying, well, let's just say Kevin, for example. Kevin's reach across his multiple social channels, today it's even furthermore now that they're back out, but you know, millions, 5, 10 million people, just him alone, not the Jonas Brothers, not. And you start to do some of the audience-based reach analyses on this. And Kevin, we find out, was personally bigger than the New York Times and NBC primetime combined in terms of the amount of people he was reaching, the frequency that he was reaching them at.
And this is the volume of followers he has across like Instagram and other types of
correct.
Social platforms.
All the gross social currency that he had.
Okay.
So you take that and you're like, well, you compare it to a media buy. You can buy reach here or reach there, but ours is more impactful because we're actually working with someone like Kevin, where we work with thousands of stars, where we would basically give them the marketing objective, the creative objective, and say, hey, create something on this. And they would speak in a capacity that was consistent with how they spoke to their audience and translated that brand however they wanted. It was, you know, a risky proposition because they could go off script and say some bad things or do things bad personally, et cetera. But it didn't happen with us. But it was incredibly impactful.
In 2013, how did you get access to thousands of celebrities and or people who could be spokespeople in the ambassador program?
Through talent agencies, I have some other celebrity friends at networks of their own as well. To your question, there was you know, a short list of 50 A-listers we had on textability, and then there was a database of thousands that we had access to through talent agencies.
And was there already a hunger in 2013? Because I'm thinking about us utilizing influencer platforms today. I feel like that's been around and just in my own focus group of one for the last couple of years, but 2013, I don't remember us having any influencer vendors to reach out to. So why were people receptive when you reached out?
Yeah, it was early days. They were receptive. Well, first of all, they probably wanted to meet Kevin in a meeting, which those are always fun. I always bring a celebrity to a sales meeting. You tend to sell something.
Great attendance.
Yeah, you get a lot of – you just break down all the criticism and objectivity. You just give me the invoice. Give me, you know. But that was – you know, that didn't always happen. But it was something new. And it was – I think the ability to translate – a brand authentically through entertainment and now through people and now through social platforms has been a conversation for quite a while that no one has still yet perfected. People are still doing it poorly. You know, the Kardashian retweets of the world, or, you know, or a lot of these, you know, the Twitch gamers, et cetera. I mean, they actually, the latter does pretty well. They translate to their particular demo, but no one has truly, genuinely created content that leverages the star's personality and brand to their audience in a genuine manner. And I think that that's what we were trying to do and did pretty well at.
One thing that's going to be very clear for anybody who's listening to the podcast is that we're jumping through so many different businesses and the different things that Sean was thinking about. So it's going to be impossible to hit on every single business. I think it's important to get into Chameleon because you're putting a lot of energy there now. That's the now the consultancy that you're putting a lot of time and energy around. What led you to starting up Chameleon? I'm just going to go ahead and table all the interesting things that you did with the ambassadorship.
Ambassador Exchange, which was in CoStar.
Yep. So CoStar, and did you sell that or no?
Yeah, we to the Engine Group, which is a holding company, an ad agency holding company, sort of a small private one.
Okay, so it just seems like we're having success after success, so that's fueling our desire to start something new. So now we're starting Chameleon. How did you come up with the name, and what was the concept now, and was it something that was different from what you had done previously?
Definitely different. Started originally by a guy named Freddie Laker, who is our we have 100 partners there, and we're all equal structure. There's no hierarchy. Freddie was a longtime publicist, Sapient Nitro guy. Freddie and a few other people like ourselves, people that classify as, you know, senior marketing executives, meaning 20 years in the business, et cetera, came together and said, you know, we want to be part of something, but we also want to be on our own at the same time. How do we do this? And we were looking at some other businesses in the marketplace, some other consultancies as well.
Yeah.
And said, what are their advantages? What are their pain points? And how do we strip down to that business down to this model of capitalizing only on the good stuff? And so that's when Chameleon Collective was formed.
Capitalizing on the good stuff. Let's just like lean into that a little bit more, because I know you had so many experiences at you know, multiple agencies. What's the good stuff and what's the bad stuff?
The good stuff is what your value proposition is, what you personally take deliver to the table, why somebody would hire you, why somebody would pay you. And in my particular instance, it was on media and marketing technology, go-to-market strategies, et cetera. So why, how you can differentiate in the marketplace and how we can get you out there. The bad stuff is, like I said earlier, the things that I'm not good at, all the operational things. If you start, you put your own shingle out, you know, you're spending half your time developing contracts, chasing bills, you're dealing with technical issues and maybe some marketing and promotion that, ironically, even though you're in the business, you realize that it's pretty time-consuming and hard. We also thought about the scalability of people as one business, you know, your own name. You might be a big name, but you can only go so far in terms of the scalability of your business under your own personal name, .com, et cetera. So we thought, let's project ourselves larger than we are. And that's when the brand Chameleon Collective was born. And to the operational part, we put together a business structure where we have full-time staff that handle our contracts and our financials and all of our technical operations and marketing and promotion, leaving all the partners, and we're like structured like a law firm. We all have our own books of business to focus on our core proposition of what we deliver. So we get to go out as individuals, individual chameleons. We also get to go out collectively and as teams. And we're coming on concluding our fourth year. And this business could have been, here's one more bad thing that we avoided. This business could have been a lot larger in terms of the partner count, but we scrutinize and are very very critical as to the types of people we bring in. We actually have to like you. You have to be a good person. Why would you ever invite somebody that you didn't care for or their style or personality into your business? Why would you invite politics into something that you've created? You just wouldn't. So we don't. So we could be thousands of partners probably, but we're only 100. And we're continually growing, but we're growing measured at the rate of business need and change as well as being a good collective as well.
So it sounds like the hierarchy or the infrastructure is stacked pretty flat.
Completely flat.
Okay.
Everybody in the collective has a continual, consistent mindset, which is that we don't want to work for someone anymore. You probably can't hire us in a full-time capacity, only on an interim basis. And we all want to... We all are beyond ourselves. We don't care about titles anymore. We don't care about accolades. It's all about the job and about accomplishing your goals for your clients and doing well at the same time. And also adapting that type of lifestyle. You know, my day is my own. I wake up every morning and my list of to-dos is extensive, but I own it, the good and the bad. And every day are wild swings to each direction. I know social media always projects everyone is just doing incredibly well and, you know, having fun all the time. But when you're an entrepreneur, man, it is what you read about. It's what you've heard. And it's gut-wrenching and it's an exhilaration to it. What it's not is boring. And if you can... work, you get to a certain point, by the way, to your questions, where you just get into the, you know, it's the you got to burn the ships, and you don't want to go back. You don't ever want to get back into that position. You know, people say, what job would you want to get back into, or would you take it? I don't have an answer for that, because I don't ever want to work for anybody but my own proposition for my clients and the businesses that I build. And that's consistent with everybody on Chameleon.
Has there ever been a moment, and there has to have been one, where you've been working independently or as an entrepreneur leading these teams that are independent of the major agencies, where you suddenly realized, I don't have access to those resources anymore. I don't have those tools at my avail. Or did you work it out such that you were like, I don't have those, but I'm going to figure out a way to gain access to them?
Yes, the latter. With your connections or, you know, license them. You can license them just as anybody else can. And usually at a very cheaper rate if they realize you're an entrepreneur. And then you realize that you're not marking it up for your own revenue. The clients appreciate that as well. So,
but sometimes there's teams you can turn to. Like if you're the president of an agency and there are hundreds of employees, or in some cases, thousands of employees that are working there, you can say, well, this division can like work on this, and then this division can work on this, and we have these strategic teams. And now when it's layered really, really flat, you've got to always be super scrappy, because there aren't just teams you can just push work to. So
true.
Did that ever become a point of realization, and how did you start to accommodate the work differently, knowing that there had been this change in structure?
Well, we have those resources and depth of teams now, where, for example, my translation of your question in my world is that I'll have a client that'll come and say, hey, we need content development, or we need recruiting, or we need somebody to help reposition our brand, or what's this crypto and blockchain stuff all about, et cetera. I don't know any of those things. So I bring in my partners that are experts in those particular areas, and then they take on those sets of the responsibilities for that client, and they're that expertise. And then they go deep with some of their like-minded partners to help solve the case.
Got it. Okay, that makes sense. So
Chameleon, remember? You're changing colors.
That's right. And you've got multiple chameleons on staff, and they can all play a role into whatever it is that you need for a client's needs. So I do want to end on asking for some pieces of advice, because I know something else you do is I believe you've either it's guest lecturing or teaching. I think you also mentioned that you have had interest in mentorship. How do you advise people who want to rise in the ranks, either because they want to do that on the agency side or they want to build up their own business? How do you, or what's the most common advice you like to share as far as being successful in your career in the media business?
I do like mentorship. What I have there are a series of personal connections with people that I care about, and they care about reaching out to me for that type of insight. And it's, a lot of it's customizable to their particular situation, you know, whether it's, like I said, rising through the ranks, or whether it's some sort of political issue, or whether it's just a complete departure of the industry. You know, that's happening a lot in our business. You know, they're finding more people on my LinkedIn profile becoming executive coaches or real estate agents or the cannabis movement. I mean, it's just crazy. But, you know, the consistent advice that I have, it goes back to, is on that finding what you're good at. Because the corollary to what you're good at is what you're not good at. And you have to be honest with yourself about that and confident that to say, okay, look, I suck at this, so I need to cut it out of my life and delegate it and bring in somebody that is good at this. And sometimes that's a little bit of an ego hit. And people, there's a lot of people, particularly in the marketing media space, that have jobs that they're doing work that they loathe, but they find it a job that pays them something, so they keep doing it. And versus maybe a little bit of courage and bravery to say, you know what, I don't like this, and or I'm not good at it, and I'd like to focus on exactly only what I am good at. And these are these three things. And for me, I'm learning, though I may have started out in media, I like building and I like creativity and I like to write and design, et cetera. Those are barely any qualities of what – that's what's sold on the media side, but truly the job is far more mundane and analytical than that.
Have there been some breakthrough moments in your life where you suddenly became self-aware of some of those weaknesses? Because I think a lot of people go through a lot of their lives and they don't come to those moments of realization. What was a moment like that for you?
I'm painfully self-aware. I'm my own best friend and my own worst enemy. And I just think that probably the conclusion of my agency time when I just realized, look, I'm just not good at these boardroom battles. I certainly don't succeed with these operational negotiations. The political stuff, you know, I don't have a lot of time for that. I think that my little take on politics in the workplace is if you have enough time to go and, you know, mess with somebody else, that's just sort of a time filler because you don't know how to do your job. And you're either in the wrong job or you're just a bad person and you need to go and figure life out somewhere else. And so you're going to go and fuck with somebody else. So that's just, I wanted to cut that out of my life too. And that's a lot of what, so the only partners that I'm affiliated with today and have been through are people that are incredibly smart and progressive and people I like. Like, again, you want to have a beer with, you want your families to hang with, that type of stuff.
As it relates to having this openness to continuously pursuing new businesses. One thing that you mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation was that, of course, like anyone, when things go wrong, you'd like to run and hide.
Sure.
But you open yourself to new opportunities that can be bountiful with success and then also bring lots of problems. How do you mentally keep yourself primed so that you're ready to face challenges?
I'm continually curious and I like to read and learn and learn new things. Like for example, right now, I know it's a little buzzy, but the notion of artificial intelligence is just fascinating to me. And it's far, if you look into it, truly, it's far more of a technical engineering type proposition than it is certainly anything related to marketing and people don't really get too deep in it. The ability to just be curious, be open to change, work out pretty quickly where the opportunities lie before you and navigate around the bad stuff to get to it are a lot of the types of mentalities that I've learned to take as being someone on my own. Every day, like I said, I wake up early, which is great.
What's early?
At least 4:35. And it's the time where I'm in my busy household where nobody's up yet. I can think. My phone's not buzzing. I think and I plan and I read and I write. And I really have never understood how people can like roll out of bed right into the work world and get anything done. I take the morning to plan and then the rest of the day is just chaotic execution. You're just there just putting out fires. And it's a quiet place process for me that I need. And I think with the distraction of devices or people, et cetera, I need that kind of forum to think through. And I'm always so thankful when I, every day that I do that, because some unique insight hits me that wouldn't have hit me in the chaos of the rest of the day.
Yeah. Well, I again want to be respectful of your time. I know we didn't touch on so many of the businesses that you have worked on, but I'm going to maybe recap on those a little bit later. Sean, I hope you have a great time at the Hall of Achievement event later this morning. And thank you so much for making time to chat with us.
Pleasure.
Thanks to Sean Finnegan, co-founder and partner at Chameleon Collective. Some observations I took away from this discussion with Sean were his dedication to confronting problems head-on and continuously reflecting on what he does and doesn't want, whether it was figuring out the prep work to start something completely new, putting in the effort to gather a complex collection of resources, or knowing when to start and stop leading an initiative. Some other takeaways from Sean on being a fearless leader included: know yourself, what you're good at and what you're not, and then take risks and bet on yourself. And when things don't work out, dust yourself off and forge ahead. And if you see a good opportunity that you want to invest your time and energy into, seize it by the horns. The rapid shifts in marketing, advertising, and technology unquestionably require more industry professionals to take a similar approach to their own leadership aspirations. That's all for this episode, but one quick request. Please subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or many of the other podcasting apps that you might be using. I'm your host, Noor Nasir. Join us next time for more At Tech Unfiltered.